This is Spotify, a product story. And I'm Gustav Söderström. I head up product, engineering, data, and design for Spotify. On this podcast, we'll share the untold stories behind Spotify's biggest product launches. What worked, what didn't, why Spotify ultimately succeeded, and the most important strategic lessons that we've learned along the way. All in the words of the people who lived it and actually made it happen. In today's episode, we'll tackle how Spotify leveraged the advent of the smartphone, a brand new world with a computer in every pocket, and went from being a free desktop app that was very, very popular, but that no one actually paid for, to being a mobile app that people happily paid for, even though they could already listen to all their pirated music on the go, for free, offline, with no ads. After 2 years in development, Spotify's desktop application officially launched in Sweden in 2008, and it was a hit. At least, it looked that way on the surface. Record labels and musicians were happy because they were finally earning money again, thanks to Spotify's royalties. Listeners were happy because the desktop app's magic trick let them listen to virtually any song they wanted faster than piracy. And Spotify was happy because through hard work and clever engineering, they had gotten a huge number of Swedes to change their behavior and start streaming music on Spotify, in spite of the ads. But if you look more closely, you could see that Spotify had only become a part of the user's music system, the discovery part. People were using Spotify's desktop app to find, share, and playlist music, but they still use Pirate Bay to download those same songs as MP3s. Then they manually recreated their Spotify playlist in iTunes so that they could load those files onto their iPods and listen offline. This is where the vast majority of listening actually happened. But here's the thing. If you listen to the last episode, How to Steal from a Pirate, you already know that it was always Spotify's ambition to be your full music system. So in order to truly replace piracy, Spotify not only had to go mobile, it had to work everywhere the iPod worked. It had to work offline. Unfortunately, music players at the time, like the iPod, were dedicated hardware devices that Spotify didn't have access to. But in 2008, the world changed.
It's the iPhone, an iPod, a cell phone, and a portable internet, all in a little lightweight package.
Smartphones happened. The iPod went from being a separate piece of hardware that you carry around to being a piece of software that lived on your phone. It was the perfect example of, as Marc Andreessen would later quip, software eating the world. This meant that Spotify could finally offer its music software on mobile devices as well, where all the listening happened. But remember, Spotify's whole proposition versus piracy was the ability to play any song you wanted faster than piracy for free, in exchange for listening to ads. First of all, an offline mobile app couldn't offer access to the world's entire music catalog. That would be physically impossible. But even more importantly, because you can't click on ads when you're offline, Spotify Mobile would have to be a paid product. This may not seem revolutionary to you now. We pay for all kinds of stuff on the internet today, right? But remember, everyone already had those exact same files that we would be asking them to pay for on their phones for free from Pirate Bay. So Spotify faced a tricky problem. How do you charge for nothing? And that's where today's episode begins.
You know, if you ask the average kid on a college campus who's carrying around, you know, half a terabyte of stuff that he's pirated, would you pay, you know, 10 bucks a month for music? The answer would be no.
That's Ken Parks. Ken built his own music startup and worked at a major record label before becoming an early advisor to Daniel Ek, Spotify's CEO. And eventually Ken went on to become Spotify's first chief content officer.
You kind of switched sides in 2007. And you left one of the big record labels to join Spotify when it was still just a tiny startup. What made you make that leap? You must have been so familiar with all the failures in streaming music and music in general, right?
Yeah, well, when Spotify came along, I mean, the highway was littered with the carcasses of companies like that, had tried all sorts of things. And, you know, Spotify is far and away the most successful streaming music company in the history of the space, but it wasn't the first streaming music company. It wasn't the first to have an ad-supported part, wasn't the first to have a paid part, but it was the first to sort of combine some things along with a sort of the equivalent of a supercar kind of product. But Gustav, I'd be lying if I said that it was super obvious from the very beginning that it was going to turn out to be this giant, you know, billion-dollar company. It wasn't at all obvious because I had that knowledge about the space and how fraught with peril it was to try to build something in that space.
As the next label guy, Ken knew how much listeners and labels value listening on the go. You might assume, like I did, that licenses to stream a song on a phone would cost the same as the license to stream that song on a desktop computer. But that's not how it works. Labels tend to charge for value, which, if you think about it, is understandable. Their job is to generate income off of their catalogs. And since mobile listening is very valuable to consumers, labels require a different license for that, one that they charge a premium for. The same exact song, the same 30 seconds of a song, cost us much, much less on the desktop than on mobile because mobility was a premium, right, mm-hmm. in the music world. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even though we could afford to stream against ads on desktop, we couldn't afford to stream the same song on mobile because we pay much more. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, I remember how upset our engineers were. Like, that's not logical. It makes no sense. It's the same bits. Like, how can they be more expensive over from this device than this device? Can you explain a little bit about just how that worked, like the different costs between desktop and mobile and how labels thought about this?
It all starts with an instinct among decision makers in the recorded music industry that is very anti-free, that continues to this day. Having seen what iTunes did in terms of taking people who used to buy CDs and get them to consume digitally, they viewed sort of as sacrosanct the portability aspect of digital music in terms of it having to be a paid experience. In their minds, the one thing that people will pay for is the ability to carry around in your pocket a piece of recorded music.
After months of negotiations and several white papers on encryption technology sent back and forth, we landed on a price. $10 a month to keep and listen to 30,000 encrypted tracks offline for up to a month before you had to reconnect and confirm that you were still a paying user, or the encryption key would expire and the files would become unplayable. Now we just had to also figure out the tiny little problem of why on earth anyone would actually pay for this service if they were already getting it for free via their pirated music solution. When we surveyed our users, we found that, not surprisingly, that was $10 a month that literally no one said that they would pay. And here's where the product side comes in. In theory, never mind the tech hurdles, we'll get to those later, if we could build a product that somehow cut out all the extra work that people were doing to manually keep their Spotify libraries in sync with their pirated music libraries, maybe, just maybe, they would eventually be willing to pay for it. Which brings us to our first product strategy lesson. Lesson number one. User research is great for understanding what people think they will do, not what they will actually do. It turns out that we humans are not very good at predicting our own future behavior, especially when it comes to what we're prepared to pay for something like convenience. We just can't imagine our future selves being that lazy. So yes, do your user research. Look at what the data says, but treat it for what it is. People trying to predict their own future reactions. And if you have a strong hypothesis for why they would react differently in reality, such as them underestimating their own willingness to actually pay for convenience, you should follow that, as those, the contrarian hypothesis, are the most valuable ones. Remember how we said convenience trumps everything in episode 1? This bet would test that product principle on a whole new level. All Our problem was that the users already had this functionality for free. Everyone was already listening on mobile. They were listening to their pirated files, right? So the question was, how much are they prepared to pay for what they're already doing for free? What was your take on that?
You're never going to take a meaningful part of that pirate world and convert it without providing the ability to listen to this stuff on your mobile. And if we just got enough people hooked on the desktop to build libraries and get them to invest in the experience, we do have a means by which we can change the thinking of the average user who's pirating music. But if you got that person invested in an experience and got him or her to spend 1,000 hours doing something, you were likely to be able to make that sale to that user successfully, because who invests 1,000 hours into something only to abandon it? And then the calculus becomes different. It becomes, well, you know, I spent 10 bucks on beer, you know, yesterday. 10 bucks is not a heavy ask to take this huge library I've built up and actually now take it with me on the device that I have, you know, in my pocket 24/7.
Right. So it turns out people don't really pay for access, because they had access to Pirate Bay and Napster. They paid for convenience, right? Which was one of the big learnings.
Correct. They paid for this holistic experience that all sorts of, you know, things around it that provided an ease of use and all kinds of other benefits that was worth paying a little bit for. So,
right.
Yeah.
It's both very cheap for all the music ever made, but it's also infinitely expensive compared to free.
I remember that being a big sticking point. What's the price going to be? Because 15 bucks, frankly, would not have been tenable for us. It would have been too much in hindsight. I believed it at the time, but we couldn't sort of prove it.
Yeah.
But it was, again, part of the argument that if you want to take people in meaningful numbers from stealing music to paying for it, you can't make the barrier too high. And it's not like these people don't have disposable income. It's just that they don't think of music as something worthy to pay for.
No user will say that they will pay for something that they can already get for free. But with a good enough product, you can prove them wrong. At least, that's what we hoped. It's often said that if you're trying to create a new habit, you should start with a minimum viable product, learn fast and iterate, and if the first product you launch isn't embarrassingly bad, you probably waited too long to launch. But every product person knows that the hardest thing you can do in product development is to change an existing habit. If you're going to try to tear people out of an existing habit that already works for them, you need to be 10 times better. Especially if that existing habit happens to be free while you're planning to charge $120 per year for it. What we needed to find was another magic trick. What if Spotify's mobile app could wirelessly keep your devices in sync by automatically downloading encrypted copies of your music over Wi-Fi? So when you were out and about, it would already be there in your pocket, waiting for you. No more torrent sites, no more manually syncing your playlists, no more USB cables. It would all just work. That might be enough of a magic trick that those users who had already spent thousands of hours building their Spotify playlists would agree with Ken and decide that the convenience of never having to plug in their iPod ever again was worth, in 2008 terms, 2 to 3 frappuccinos per month. We had our work cut out for us. And because the iPhone's operating system was based on OS X, the bulk of that work fell on one of our first Mac developers, Matthias Arrelid, who joined Spotify a few years earlier.
I got a binary sent to me that was basically like 50K. It was so tiny. And I'm like, okay, is this like an executable? Sure, it is.
What can so little code actually do, right?
Yeah, but there was a user interface. You could do things. You could interact with it. You could search. You could play. But that was on Windows only. And again, quite narrow in both feature and scope at that time.
Was the performance already there in terms of speed of playback and these like the classic Spotify advantages?
Performance was pretty good at that time, but also you need to remember that this was basically a lab environment. Also, like, we didn't have any users. We had a crappy storage server set up in one of the cupboards, basically, in the office. So yeah, I mean, under perfect conditions, it started to stream in like milliseconds. But yeah, you got the magic of it straight away.
Yeah, so it was clear that if this would scale, it would be an experience that didn't exist at the time.
Yeah, and I think that was also one of the deciding factors why I joined. Like, you show me something like this, and if this works, this is going to blow people's minds, definitely.
But even if the code that Spotify's early engineers had built was extremely small and resource efficient, and incredibly ran on an iPhone almost out of the box, it turns out that you always optimize for something, even without realizing it. And that's product strategy lesson number two. It's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it's unavoidable and even a desirable thing. But it does result in some blind spots.
So can you talk through some of the challenges as we looked at how we would actually make Spotify a good mobile product versus just technically getting the desktop to run on a phone?
I mean, there are two things that stand out straight away when you ask that question. One is just taking what we had and get it running on the phone was, I mean, not just technically feasible, we did it. But then that is a phone that doesn't have a constant power supply, for example. It doesn't have a constant high bandwidth network connection. And both of them present very interesting challenges in terms of what we had on our backend. So Spotify was, at that time at least, leveraging peer-to-peer to a large degree to distribute music quickly, efficiently, and also cheaply, both for the consumer and for us. If you do that on the phone, you basically force it to keep the radio on quite a bit, and that is draining in terms of battery. And you didn't really have a permanent power supply from the beginning, so like you're making things not just worse, much worse. The other one is data, where you had Spotify running on the desktop and you relied on like, well, there's definitely some kind of data connection here that I don't really need to care about it. There's data. On the phone, you have contracts, or at least at that time, you had many contracts that had limited bandwidth included in the monthly allowance. So you really wanted to be careful about your consumption of that. And then you need to actually understand or know, like, how much data have I consumed and how much data does the user have in terms of their plan? And of course, it turns out that there are no APIs for this. Like, you never know. So we actually had to be pretty resourceful, and we had to monitor basically all the network connections on the phone. And as soon as we noticed that there was a Wi-Fi connection available, we had to like try to force switch both audio streaming and audio caching to just like stop 3G or Edge or whatever it was, and like make the switch to Wi-Fi instead, because that is going to be better for us and cheaper for the user.
I mean, one way you could look at this is, whether you understand it or not, when you do something, you're going to optimize it. You don't understand what you optimize for until you do something else. So when you sit and develop for a desktop, you're probably, and we're trying to reduce latency. That's what we're optimizing for. You're going to, quote unquote, abuse the other things. You're going to use CPU because it's cheap. You're going to use memory because it's cheap. You're going to use bandwidth because it's cheap. So you're going to accept, for example, much more overhead if latency can be lower. So, for example, instead of waiting for packages to sum up before you send them so you can get lower overhead, you would do the opposite. More overhead if the latency goes down. So technically, all of this worked when you switched to mobile, but the constraints changed. Like, you know, CPU was expensive because it drains battery. Memory was limited and the bandwidth was super expensive. So technically it was the same, but constraint-wise, it was completely different, right?
Yeah, both true and false at the same time. I think in terms of just allocating memory overall, that core library was fairly like kind to the system. But still, like it wasn't really kind enough. It still ran into all of those things that you talk about. But it also put us in a pretty good position because we actually had thought about these things. And I think many other players were completely like coming from a very desktop heavy angle where like we haven't thought about this at all, like period.
So the fair thing to say is we actually hadn't abused any of these things. We were actually quite disciplined and it was quite efficient on desktop. And that's part of the reason why it worked at all straight out of the box on these more limited devices.
Yeah, except in terms of network and bandwidth and how much data you use, because like that was basically used for free.
Exactly. So peer-to-peer was obviously off the table, both for power and bandwidth reasons.
Yeah.
But then even just a regular streaming would get quite expensive with the data costs back then. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, definitely. But also, now that you mention it, today it's easy to forget, but at that time, the operating systems, the mobile operating systems, they were very aggressive in terms of killing your application unless it was up in front of the user. So just things like you would take for granted on the desktop, like, yeah, you don't really need to play anything in the app, and the app would still be like running, and it could be offline syncing tracks. Nope. Like on the mobile, you basically had to fake this. You could play like a silent stream to not be killed by the operating system if you wanted to do any kind of background work at all. Because if you remember things correctly, what we had as like an offering to the consumers was, you pay us $9.99 a month and then you can offline sync things.
So on desktop, we had used an open source codec named Ogg Vorbis. And one of the reasons we did that, one of the drawbacks of that was that codec was not really hardware supported on most PCs and so forth. On the other hand, you usually had a large CPU. So let's pay in CPU performance instead, because you have a fixed connection to your socket in the wall. And what was the benefit of this? Why didn't we use it? Well, we could actually then go into the protocol and remove all of these unnecessary headers that this codec had.
Yeah.
And we could shave seconds off of playback, which was the whole point, right?
Yeah.
So we got end-to-end control by using an open source codec.
It worked really well on the desktop. It was efficient. Sure, it was CPU bound, but you had plenty of CPU available. And you could also optimize it to make it even more efficient, because again, you had complete control of the source code. On the mobile, on the other hand, again, like CPU is more expensive, and also in terms of hardware decoding, if you can't really get any help of the operating system, you're going to use even more power and more energy.
Back then, smartphones didn't have dedicated floating point units called FPUs, which meant that Ogg Vorbis was actually very resource intensive on a mobile device and would drain your battery in no time. So on mobile, as our first fix to improve battery performance, we switched to a version named Ogg Tremor that relied on much cheaper fixed point operations. This meant that we could still trim the headers to have the low latency experience when you happen to be on Wi-Fi. And because it played the same files, we didn't have to transcode our entire library of Ogg Vorbis files into a whole new codec format, so we could get to market fast with a working product. But the right long-term solution to be power efficient would be to use one of the hardware-accelerated codecs instead. While it took a few years for the hardware-accelerated codecs like AAC to catch up in terms of latency, and we would need to transcode our entire library, mobile phones had one big advantage over desktops. The AAC codec was already licensed and paid for on smartphones. Now, when that came to mobile, it turned out that native support for codecs was much more important.
So, yeah, we also had to make some changes in terms of the codecs that we used. And to go out on a tangent here, this has implications not just on the mobile. This had implications on the backend services, licensing, all these kind of questions come into play as well. Because, again, like we had picked a codec that was fairly easy to use, fairly easy to understand in terms of licensing. But also fairly, if not hard-coded into the protocol, so fairly like, yes, this is what we do, and we don't really do anything else, because it's superior to, say, MP3. But yeah, no hardware support for that on the iPhone, so we had to, I think, we picked AAC or something as one of the first formats or additional formats that we transcoded the whole catalog to.
The choices you make, you optimize for things without thinking about it, and so, I mean, we wanted to give Spotify away for free. So we couldn't have a license cost attached to it. And so we chose Ogg Vorbis, and it seemed like a great choice. But then the problem with that was that codec wasn't actually hardware supported almost anywhere. Then when mobile came along, that turned into a real problem, because it got important to be more careful with using CPU. And to use CPU for decoding audio wasn't very friendly to the battery. But on the other hand, for the iPhone, the AAC codec was already licensed and paid for. So there we actually wouldn't bring on that cost. So for us, it would work to use AAC on the iPhone because someone was paying for the codec. Yeah. Whereas on desktop, we would have paid to basically, ship a version of that codec, right? So it's all these interesting business things that end up deciding how your product works, right?
Yeah, kind of comes back to me now too, because I think if you had iTunes installed on your Windows computer, you would actually have the AAC support.
Exactly, because then it was paid for again.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Good times.
And that segues perfectly into our third and final product strategy lesson. on the power of combined innovation around technologies like encryption, wireless sync and codecs, with business model and licensing innovations like the offline offering. Lesson number three. Really great product development is more than just a cool new feature or even a breakthrough new technology. Really great product development almost always combines technological innovation with business model innovation. We tend to think of the tech side and the business side as operating separately, but to have the biggest impact, they have to work together to shape the product, especially at a company like Spotify. And that's a good thing. Just ask Peter Hansson, Spotify's first general counsel.
Spotify sort of stands on two legs. Obviously, the technology. That being, you know, again, there were other streaming services. Spotify did not invent streaming, but it was such a nice, clean, user-friendly experience and so intuitive and fast. That was one leg or one sort of success factor. But if you don't have any content, it doesn't matter how good your tech is, I'm sorry, but people won't use it anyway. So the other leg for me is obviously getting the content in. And I think for me, a huge success factor for Spotify was our licenses, because they were unique. At that time, no one had the licenses we had. Again, others had the tech, the streaming. So that was truly unique. Then streaming and Spotify kind of became the norm. But that was new, novel, and a huge success factor.
Many product managers forget about the business innovation part, leaving the real product half done. Even some of Spotify's early competitors essentially seemed content to launch first and figure out the details later.
We spend a lot of time getting those licenses right because, you know, back in the day, the norm was more to just sign any licenses and then, you know, try and flip the company so it became someone else's problem, or companies would go belly up. So we were sort of hellbent, and that's one of the reasons why I joined, because I really liked about the company, that Daniel's vision was always to build something long-term sustainable, not just, oh, just get some licenses and then we'll flip the company.
In retrospect, these negotiations, as frustrating as they may have been at times, forced Spotify to be a smarter, more strategic company.
The access model and subscription, I think that scared the music rights holders a little bit, because they kind of knew that it meant that they no longer owned and controlled the distribution channel, which they kind of are used to doing. If you look on the sort of record label side and major labels, they're very powerful players, they're monopolists on their catalogue. You cannot license their catalogue from anybody else. So it's very easy for them to just say no, because they can. And they're used to calling the shots. And here was like a small startup from a strange cold country up north, you know, not taking no for an answer, just keeping, you know, actually arguing with them to do something quite scary, namely something they've never done before.
Spotify literally had to negotiate every new feature or addition to its business model with at least four major labels, meaning that it took substantially longer to pilot new ideas than for a normal company, like maybe a Facebook, Google, or Twitter, that could just ship code and A/B test it, instead of always debating its benefits and drawbacks and consequences. Spotify couldn't afford to be wrong very often, because being wrong would be too expensive. Licensing the wrong thing for 4 years could have killed the company. So we learned to be more careful, to prioritize brutally, scenario plan, game out and think through second and third order consequences of our decisions to a larger degree than perhaps other companies have had to. With the licensing deal signed and the tech in place, the paid mobile tier launched in 2009. And while media coverage was very skeptical that anyone would agree to pay $120 a year for it, they did love the product. And, sure enough, after a few weeks, we saw the conversion moment start to happen. First, a small percentage of our user base, then gradually more and more. The bar for freemium models at the time was Skype, which converted about 7% of the users to pay at least something, maybe a dollar. We hit that in a few months, but it just continued from there, past 10%, 15%, 20%, and we realized that we had stumbled on what might just be the most effective freemium model the world had ever seen. All of a sudden, Spotify had gone from a company that was growing users fast, relying on venture capital, to a company that was also growing revenue fast and had a real sustainable business model. At least for a while, until everything started to fall apart.
We went into negative growth. And as a startup, that's like, then you're dead. Like, that's so few startups recover after growth disappears.
That's coming up in next week's episode on Spotify's first mobile free tier. But before we go, here's a quick recap of the lessons we covered today. Lesson number one, user research is great for understanding what people think they will do, not what they will actually do. Remember that when you ask users what they think they will do, what you get is exactly that. Lesson number two, whether you realize it or not, you're always optimizing for something. Lesson number three, really great product development almost always combines technological innovation with business model innovation. If you want to see what that new magic trick, the seamless synchronization between devices, looked like back then when no one else was doing it yet, click the YouTube link in the show notes to see the original demo of the magic trick at Google I.O. in San Francisco all the way back in 2009. That's it for this week's episode on Spotify's move to mobile. Spotify, a product story, is produced by Munk Studios for Spotify. Veronica Harth is our in-house Spotify correspondent. We're edited by Francis Harlow and mixed by Joachim Löfgren, Victor Bergdahl, and Andrea Fantussi. Our theme music was composed by Andrea Fantussi. Special thanks to Niklas Ivarsson. I'm Gustav Söderström. Thank you for listening. Sometimes, when you walk into a room, you just know it's about to change your life. And sometimes, you don't.
I wouldn't say that it was a company. It was more like you enter this random apartment, and in that apartment, you find a couple of people sitting at their keyboards, basically chugging away at this grand ambition